Good evening. It's good to see you. I wish it was because of something other than what it's about. It's always troubling to have to gather around the terror of history. I'm David Goa, the director of the Ronning Center, and I'm delighted to introduce my colleague and friend Ibrahim Aburabi. He is the professor of Islamic Studies at the University of Alberta in Edmonton for a number of years. Was at Hartford Seminary as the director of the program on Muslim-Christian dialogue. He is a scholar of contemporary Islamic thought, the editor of The Muslim World, which no doubt all of you subscribe to, or at least after tonight you will, which has been published now for almost 100 years. Mm-hmm. It's a remarkable journal. And over Christmas, I read his book on the spiritual dimensions of the thinking of Sayyid Nursi, which is a remarkable, wonderful study. And I'll also point out to you that he recently published his book on the intellectual origins of Islamic resurgence in the modern Arab world, SUNY, University Press. And then this little doorstop, which is a marvelous work for any of us who are interested in what is taking place in the Muslim world, the Blackwell's Companion to Contemporary Islamic Thought. I highly recommend it to you. Ibrahim is one of the finest scholars in the world on contemporary Islamic thought. He has mapped that world both intellectually and within its political embodiment as well, from Indonesia to Algiers. So we couldn't have anyone better to think with us tonight about what is taking place in Gaza, what lies behind it, and to ponder a little bit together how we might then live. Ibrahim grew up in Nazareth, walked the pathways where Jesus walked as a child. Some of you commented on your way in, was there room in the inn? And I wanted to say, this is Nazareth, not Bethlehem. So welcome. Thank you, Ibrahim.
Thank you.
I know that these issues are awfully, awfully troubling to people who, to all of us, and certainly to anyone who lives in the midst of these terrors of history. So it's, I so much appreciate you coming, and I also appreciate how difficult it is in trying to, again and again and again, try to find some way through these matters. So welcome.
Thank you so much, David. Thank you. Good evening. Assalamu alaikum. I am not going to give a talk in Arabic or other languages, but in English. Let's suppose that we are like the ex-President Bush. We speak only English. I just heard somebody here in the middle saying that they have just come back from Mexico. It's amazing. Why would you come back from Mexico to Cairo in the cold? Well, I'm delighted to be here once again. This is like my fourth time speaking here at this part of the university. And as my friend David has said, I am Palestinian, but I was born in the State of Israel. So officially, I carry an Israeli passport. In addition, I carry an American passport because I live in the USA for 20 years. So I carry the two passports, or the most powerful countries in the world, the USA and Israel. And this is a real strength for a Palestinian. It's a real defense mechanism, like you are born in Calgary or something. Yeah. Of course, the situation in Palestine and the Arab-Israeli conflict of late, that whole situation is extremely tragic. And this is only one dimension of the tragedy, because it seems to me that the tragedy has been going on for over a century, perhaps since at least 1948. So there is so much to talk about, and for us who come from that part of the world, we began to learn about the tragedy not from books or from TV, but from our parents, from oral history, from our friends, from our families. In my own case, for example, there were lots of family members who became refugees in 1948 when Israel was founded. Refugees in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Kuwait, that I was not able to see because on my Israeli passport I was not able to travel. And any Israeli cannot travel on their passports, let's say, to Syria and Lebanon nowadays. They can do that to Egypt and Jordan. But I was able to travel on my American passport 20 years ago to Syria to see my aunt and three uncles. And in a sense, I became connected mentally and psychologically to the whole tragedy of Palestine. And I just want to share this with you, that when I first met my aunt in the refugee camp in Damascus, the first thing that she said to me, she was 75 years old at the time, she passed away 5-6 years ago, she said to me, "I do not hate Jews, I just want to go back to my homeland." And in a sense, that is representative of the majority of Palestinians, Arabs and Muslims. Because as you well know, and here I'm not being defensive about history, there had been a tradition of hospitality in the Arabo-Islamic civilization. Even before Islam, of course, in terms of Jews and Christians, they existed in the Arab world or in Arabia before Islam. Since Judaism and Christianity are more ancient than Islam, historically speaking. But within the Arabo-Islamic civilization, Jews and Christians have been accepted as part of that civilization. And that's why in the Islamic sacred text, Jews and Christians are referred to as the people of the book, Ahlul Kitab, those who possess a sacred text. And the Quran is quite explicit about not coercing the Ahlul Kitab, Jews and Christians, to accept Islam. It's not acceptable from an Islamic theological perspective to force Jews and Christians to accept Islam. In addition, you know, if one looks not only at the theological history of especially Judaism, in addition to Christianity, but let's focus on Judaism. If one looks at the economic and social history of Jews within Islam, one major historical fact is that most Jews in the world lived in the Arab Muslim world until more or less 300 years ago. That's to say, if you look at the entire Jewish history, most of it had been spent with Arabs and Muslims and not with Europeans or North Americans or Latin Americans, like not like in Argentina. The migration of Jews to Argentina took place like 80 years ago, 100 years ago. But Jews had been there in the Arab-Muslim context for centuries. And, you know, one could give many specific examples about the social and economic history of Jews in Islamic civilization. But I want to remind you of the major work done by Professor Guyton of the Hebrew University on the socioeconomic history of Jews in medieval Islam, where he analyzed what we call the Geniza documents, which are now at Princeton University. These were documents that were discovered in 1910 in a Jewish synagogue in Cairo, in ancient Cairo. And later on they were sold to an American manuscript collector in the 1940s. But Professor Guaitin analyzed the socioeconomic history of Jews in medieval Islam, especially in Egypt, from the 10th century all the way until the Ottomans conquered Egypt in 1517. And what he discovered was amazing is that, you know, Egypt, as you well know, since the beginning of Islam until 1952, had never been ruled by a native Egyptian. Egypt had always been ruled by military elites that came outside of Egypt, either from Baghdad or Syria, or by what we call the Mamluks, the Circassians and the Armenians who became Muslims before the Ottomans and after the Ottomans. So they were like at the higher echelon of Egyptian military society. And the second level was occupied by Jews in that society, and not by Muslims per se. And most of the Muslims were peasants, what we call in Arabic fellahin, and that term is used in English too. Fellahin in Upper Egypt or Lower Egypt. Therefore, if one is to analyze the socioeconomic position of Jews and Judaism and Christians and Christianity in the Arabo-Islamic context, we would come to different results that we are led to believe by the mass media nowadays about, let's say, ancient hostilities between Arabs and Jews, or between Muslims and Christians, which is not true on the basis of historical and socioeconomic evidence. That's one major point that we have to bear in mind, is that there had always been a tradition of hospitality in the Arab-Muslim world for what we call Ahl al-Kitab. Of course, at certain historical junctures, that tradition was betrayed by certain Muslim rulers. I mean, they were not perfect, no one is perfect. But by and large, Jews and Christians, in certain cases, in terms of their socioeconomic status and educational status, fared better much more than the rest of the population in Muslim lands. Now, this tradition, I believe, was very much destroyed because of the rise of a major movement in the 19th century that we call Zionism. And we can talk about that from different angles, but let me take this one major angle, which is historical. In the 19th century, in what we call the Middle East nowadays, and as you well know, the term Middle East was invented by the British at the beginning of the 19th century in 1813 to describe what we call the Arab lands, the Middle East. In the 19th century in the Middle East, there were, almost four or five different competing ideologies for the making of the modern Middle East. And the major ideology or perspective had been adopted by the Ottoman state. The Ottoman state was defeated in World War I, as you well know. It was officially abolished in 1923 with Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey. But in the 19th century, the Ottoman state was trying to survive in the whole turmoil, political and economic turmoil of the Middle East and the world at the time. And the major pressure on the Ottoman state came from the different European states. And that's why the Ottoman political, military, and religious elites invented what we call pan-Islam. That's to say, a pan-Islamic ideology as a way to modernize and solidify the Ottoman Empire so that the empire can withstand the pressures coming from Europe, from Russia before the Bolshevik Revolution, from France, from England, from Austria, from different European powers that had been meddling in the internal affairs of the Ottoman state. So pan-Islam had been a significant ideological movement in the Middle East, in the Ottoman world, in the Arab world, and many Palestinians followed pan-Islam, because we must remember that Palestine had been part of the Ottoman world. So at the time we are talking about Ottoman Palestine, not British Palestine. We're not talking about the British Mandate. So pan-Islam, therefore, was a significant movement at the time. The second major significant movement was Turkish nationalism, because Turkish nationalism begins to emerge in the 19th century. And Turkish nationalism was much more narrower in focus than pan-Islam. Turkish nationalism did not concern itself with Muslims or with Arabs. It concerned itself or Kurds or Armenians, except by killing Armenians perhaps. It was concerned about the creation of a sovereign Turkish state for the Turkish people. And it succeeded somewhat in 1924, 6 years or so after the defeat of the Ottoman army in the war. But Turkish nationalism had its roots back perhaps in the 18th century or the beginning of the 19th. And the third major power, ideological movement, was Arab nationalism, because Arabs now, or some of them at least, who were army officers in the Ottoman army in Iraq, in Palestine, in Syria, in Transjordan, in Lebanon, as well as in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, all of these regions that had been under Ottoman domination, were saying, well, if Turks want to establish a Turkish state, then we as Arabs have the right to establish our own state. So therefore, Arab nationalism was a movement that was emerging at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And as a matter of fact, one of the leading ideologues of Arab nationalism at the time, in the early part of the 20th century, was the British-educated Palestinian thinker George Antonius, who wrote a major book in 1918 by the title, in English, by the title of The Arab Awakening. And the fourth major movement that was competing in terms of ideology, especially over land, was Zionism. Now, if you look at pan-Islam, Turkish nationalism, and Arab nationalism, all of these movements emerged within the Middle East. They were indigenous to the Middle East. Whereas Zionism was not indigenous. It was not born in the Middle East. But above all, it was not born amongst the Jews of the Arab and the Muslim world. Because Zionism as a movement was born initially in Russia, in Eastern Europe, then it moved its headquarters to perhaps Germany, from Germany to England, and after 1948 or so it moved its center to Washington, D.C. and is still entrenched in Washington, D.C. So if Canada becomes a major empire, maybe it will move its headquarters to Edmonton or Calgary or whatever, you know. This might have happened so far, you know, part of the center has moved here. But the point here is that Zionism had been a European phenomenon responding to the issues and problems facing Jews and Jewish communities within Europe, which in a sense had nothing to do with Islam and Muslim societies or with Arabism and Arab societies. And therefore, if we look at what happens a century later, nowadays, after the emergence of all of these ideologies at the end of the 19th century, what we see is a major decline, if not defeat, of pan-Islam. And pan-Islam was defeated by the time that the Ottoman state was dismantled. In addition, that Turkish nationalism was defeated too. I mean, many Turkish nationalists would not believe that, but I believe that Turkish nationalism has been defeated, and Arab nationalism has been defeated as well, in stages. In 1967, when Israel attacked Syria, Egypt, and Jordan, it was defeated perhaps when Saddam Hussein was removed from power 6 years ago or so. So you could argue that Arab nationalism is no longer a major ideology or a dominant ideology in what we call the Arab world and North Africa nowadays. But Zionism is still a major ideology, not only in the Middle East, but in the world at large, especially in the Western world. And this has its own major reasons. You know, to me it's baffling that Zionism has been able to preserve its own power and even expand its own power over the past century at the expense of so many different ideologies and forces in the Middle East and the world. You know, this is perhaps a joke, but one time I was in Jerusalem, and in the Arab part of the city, you know, in the Arab tourist shops, you would buy a T-shirt where on the back it's written in Arabic, Hebrew, and English, America, don't worry, Israel is behind you. So that testifies to the power of Zionism nowadays, you know. I do believe, you know, I mean, and perhaps this is not a joke, that Zionism has two powerful states, Israel and the USA today. And that's why I'm not proud to carry the passports of the two powerful states of the world. But anyway, so if we go back to Zionism, you know, it's very interesting to look at the origins of Zionism. And there have been a number of scholarly writings on that from different perspectives, including the Arab perspective. But there's no doubt that Zionism in its own emergence, as well as in its own maturation, has not admitted that Arabs, not only Palestinians, that Arabs are civilized people. And this is the behavior of Zionism vis-a-vis the Arabs until now. Although if you look at the tradition of hospitality, you know, no Holocaust had ever happened within the Arab or Islamic context. And it would never have happened because of Islamic ethics and because of Quranic rules and this and that. And I would say that in many ways, if you compare the Arab-Islamic civilization of the past to the current Western civilization, I mean, there's no doubt that in World War II, millions of innocent Jews were slaughtered within the Western civilization. And there are lots of questions nowadays, you know, from the Jewish side, from the European side, how did that happen? You know, I was in Germany a few months ago, and I was saying that basically the Palestinians as a people have been made to bear the brunt of the Holocaust, although they had nothing to do with the Holocaust. They did not cause the Holocaust. Not the Palestinians, not the Arabs, not the Muslims. It was an inter-European affair. But in a sense, Germany was let free by paying $6 billion or so to the State of Israel after 1948. And no one, you know, talks about, I mean, of course, there's so much talk and literature about the Holocaust, what happened in the 1940s, but no one seems to blame Germany nowadays. You know, Germany has gotten free. Whereas the Palestinians have borne, you know, that brunt and that tragedy since at least 1948. And that's very interesting indeed, because, you know, it's like, you know, for Israel to accept money for the blood of the innocent Jews shed in Germany, you know, I mean, I wouldn't accept $6 billion for an innocent Jewish soul, for one soul, not even $6 billion. But that tells you about politics, of course, that's another issue. But the major point is that Palestinians have been made to pay, perhaps, for some of the problems in modern European history that they had nothing to do with. And therefore, one of the biggest questions that face us is this. When does the Arab-Israeli conflict begin? Does it begin with the rise of Zionism at the end of the 19th century? Does it begin with the Balfour Declaration of November 1917? Does it begin with the actual conquest of Palestine after the defeat of the Ottoman army in November of 1918? Does it begin with the foundation of Israel in 1948? Or does it begin even before then with the Holocaust? You know, these are significant questions. And I just want to shed some light, if I may, on one major point, is that as you well know, Germany for a long time, during what we call the Enlightenment centuries, had been the center or one of the centers of European Enlightenment. Germany, France, Holland, later on England. But Germany, no doubt, had been a center of what we call Enlightenment. But also Germany had been the center for at least 200 years of what we call Jewish Enlightenment, what we call in Hebrew Haskalah. Haskalah as a term is taken from the Hebrew language or noun, seichel. Seichel means mind in Hebrew. So it is the moment or the project of Jewish rationalism. And the major representative of that was Mendelssohn, Moses Mendelssohn of the 18th century in Germany, the German Jewish philosopher Mendelssohn, who died at the end of the 18th century. So when Zionism emerged in the 19th century, no one ever thought that Germany as a state and as a nation and as an elite and as an army would be the site of the Holocaust against the Jewish people, because for centuries Germany had been the center of Jewish Haskalah and Enlightenment. How come that these enlightened people would slaughter millions of innocent people, Jews and non-Jews? No one ever imagined that. However, at the same time, Zionism had been determined in the 19th century to create a national homeland for the Jewish people, 50 years or so before the Holocaust. Which means that, I would say that historically, the Holocaust was not the beginning of the state of Israel. The Holocaust might have sped up the process of creating Israel, but it was not the reason for the creation of Israel, as we are led to believe by Israeli propaganda nowadays, or Zionist propaganda in the world. Because the Zionist movement was very clear by 1897 that we want Palestine as our land, as Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. We want to return to our land. Because, you know, Arabs have occupied our land for 2,000 years. And they did not even pay rent for the rents. It's time for them to leave. You know, as simple as that. It's time for them to get out. So that was basically the position of Zionism towards the Palestinians. The Palestinians are not a nation. They are not a people. They do not belong to a civilization. And the Zionists denied and they turned a blind eye to the contributions and the achievements of the Arab-Islamic civilization vis-a-vis Jews and Judaism. That's not to be found in Zionist literature. Even when the Zionists talk about the Inquisition in Spain, they say that it is only Jews who were expelled or tortured at the hands of the Spaniards. They don't even mention Arabs and Muslims. And historically, it was Muslims and Jews who were mistreated in the phase or in that era of the Inquisition. And therefore, I believe that from a historical perspective, Zionism has become a huge problem to the peoples of the Middle East, not only the Palestinians, but Arabs and Muslims and other people. And it has been a huge problem ever since, ever the 19th century. Because Zionism denies and refuses any sort of coexistence between Jews and, let's say, Arabs, or between Jews and Muslims. Because it is not willing to understand and to accept the long centuries of coexistence and cooperation between Arabs and Jews, or Muslims and Jews. Because when we talk about Arabs, there have been lots of Arab Jews as well, like Arab Christians. This is one major problem that I see in Zionist thinking. Now, of course, you know, no one is arguing that Zionism has been a linear movement or mono-movement, because there have been many divisions within Zionism, which is normal. And nowadays, as a matter of fact, those Zionist forces that are, you know, for peace with the Arabs and all of that, I believe are a small minority within Zionism. That's to say that the pragmatic revisionist trend of Zionism that was in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s represented by Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was a Russian Jew who lived in England, who died in England in 1937, that type of Zionism is pretty dominant in Israeli politics and society nowadays. And one of the major representatives of that is Netanyahu. Sharon, until he formed what he calls the Party Kadima, which means progress. I don't know what type of progress is that in Hebrew. So that type of Zionism has never wanted to negotiate with the Arabs. But however, Zionism, although it has succeeded, although it succeeded in 1948 to establish its own state, a very strong state, and later on to establish perhaps the strongest army, not only in the Middle East, but in the world, Zionism has faced and is still facing some major problems. And you can say that these major problems are classified into two types. The first one is, or the first ones are external problems, and the second ones are internal. On the external side, for example, most Jews of the world so far, until now, 60 years or so after the foundation of the State of Israel, refused to migrate to Israel, most Jews of the world. Israel roughly has 6 million Jews, perhaps even less, because there are 1.5 million Palestinians who are Israeli citizens as well. So let's say that we have 6 million Jews in Israel, out of a total Jewish population in the world of 18 million. So 12 million so far have refused to migrate to Israel. They might support Israel financially. They might write in the paper. They might, you know, whatever, do everything on behalf of Israel. But in actuality, the Zionist project has always wanted those Jews to gather in Eretz Israel in order to safeguard Jews, especially after the Holocaust. This is one problem, that in terms of demography, the Jewish state of Israel has not been able to attract most of the Jews of the world. And the second major problem externally for the Israeli state since 1948 is the fact that Israel had been built on the premise, from a Jewish perspective, that it is a state that would protect Jews. Now, Jews in Israel have been the least safe Jews in the world since the Holocaust, the end of the Holocaust, because Israel has been established on ethnic cleansing, on a land that belonged to another people, on the expulsion of another people, on expansion at the expense of other people. So the Jews of Israel have been the least safe since 1948. In Germany since 1948, the Jews of Germany have been the safest, much more safe than the Jews of Israel. And this is very true in the USA. It's even very true in Myanmar. I went to Myanmar 2 years ago, and I met a few Jewish families, and they feel extremely safe. They don't feel any desire to migrate to the land of honey and whatever. On the internal side, the major problem is that Israel has not succeeded so far in dealing, in finding a lasting solution to the Palestinian demographic problem. Because if you look at the Palestinian population within Israel, as I said, 20% of the Israeli citizens officially are Palestinians who belong to the same culture, who speak the same language. Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims and Palestinian Jews, like in the Palestinian city of Nablus, Shechem in the Old Testament, on the West Bank, there is a very, very small ancient Jewish community, the Samaritan community, of like 500 people or so, who have, you know, refused to migrate to Tel Aviv, let's say, from Nablus. So we have Palestinian Jews. And we have had, you know, in history, a long history of Palestinian Judaism that was part of the Ottoman world and before then part of other regimes, the Mamluks and then the Fatimids and so on and so forth. So therefore, we have 1.5 million Palestinians within Israel. When Israel was founded, the Palestinians were only 250 or so, between 250 to 300. But nowadays there are 1.5 million people. Then if you look at the Palestinians on the West Bank, roughly we have 3 million Palestinians on the West Bank, Gaza 1.5 million. So we're talking about an equal number of Palestinians and Jews that are under Israeli domination, roughly. Especially because most of the Jews so far have refused to migrate to the state of Israel. In Hebrew we call it aliyah, to make aliyah to the state of Israel. So I believe that this is the most significant problem that Israel and the Zionist project is facing in Israel. The fact of a Palestinian demography, a major Palestinian demography. Because in Zionism, they want territorial expansion without people. That's to say, they want the land, but they don't want the people. And that's why if you read carefully the Balfour Declaration, the text of the Balfour Declaration, it does not refer to Palestinians or Arabs as Palestinians or Arabs. It refers to them as non-Jewish communities in the Holy Land, non-Jewish communities. So they are not even one community. So when Israel was founded, as a matter of fact, 3 years after Israel was founded, a law was passed in the Knesset was Palestinians within Israel were divided into Druze, Circassians, Bedouins, Christians, and Muslims. Five different divisions. Now the Bedouins are Muslims, and the Circassians are Muslims, and the Druze are Muslims. If you are a liberal Muslim, you would say that the Druze are Muslims.
Very liberal.
But nevertheless, you know, the Palestinian body, Palestinian society was divided into five different divisions. And because of that, Israel has, in a sense, forced the Druze to serve in the Israeli army. So the Druze population, especially the men, must serve in the Israeli army after high school, just like any other Israeli man or woman. Now, Israel has allowed the Bedouins to serve in the army. That's not, you know, by force, but most Bedouins serve in the Israeli army. The Circassians were a small minority. I don't know how much you know about the history of the Circassians. The Circassians were sent to Ottoman Palestine in 1876 after the defeat of the Ottoman Empire in its Crimea War with Russia between 1873 and 1876, at the end of the 19th century. So some Circassians went to Palestine, others went to the Golan Heights, others went to Damascus, Amman, Jordan. As a matter of fact, Amman, Jordan had been founded by Circassians who came from what we call Georgia nowadays. I guess the western part of Georgia or so. So here, therefore, internally Israel is facing a major demographic problem. And that's why, you know, the question of the recent Israeli assault on what Israel has called Hamas has been an assault on not Hamas per se. It has been an assault on a large number of Palestinian refugees. Because if you go to the Gaza Strip, I don't know how many of you have been there. I've been there, I forget how many times, 20, 30 times. That 80% of the people of Gaza today, the Gaza Strip, not only the city, but the Gaza Strip, are refugees from what we call nowadays Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Lud, Ramla, Ashkelon, Ascalon in Arabic, and so on and so forth. So it's a major assault, once again, on Palestinian refugees in Gaza. And that tells me in a philosophical way that Zionism still does not have a solution for the refugees except to try to exterminate them. And that's impossible. Because the refugees are rising up and they are resisting in a major way in the name of Hamas, in the name of Jihad, in the name of whatever. It could be in the name of Osama bin Laden or George Bush. It doesn't matter. What matters is that the refugees are waking up to the fact that they cannot afford to become refugees again for a second or third time. And in order to preserve their raison d'etre, their identity, they have to resist the Israeli army, even if they were all killed. And that's why Israel has no end in sight. In terms of the recent attack, Israel knows and knew beforehand that it will never succeed in stamping out Palestinian resistance, because there had been so much anger building up for the past century or so amongst the Palestinians because of their own dispossession, this and that. So that whole situation is not about a few rockets fired by Hamas or Jihad and killing a few Israelis here and there. I mean, Israel has killed in this war 1,350 Palestinians, most of whom have been children and women. Most of whom have been civilians. They have not been from Hamas or Jihad. So, therefore, here we have another major crisis, which is another dimension of the continuation of this crisis since at least 1948. And it's like, you know, the whole Arab world, including Hamas, have been willing to sit down and negotiate. Even Hamas had said for the past 20 years, indirectly, we know that we cannot throw the Jews to the sea, for example. We know we cannot destroy the state of Israel, but at least give us a small state on the West Bank, Gaza. Like, give us a small state between Edmonton and Calgary, something like that. Because the West Bank is pretty small. And Israel has refused. The Arab world has been willing since the offer of the Arab League of 2002 for a comprehensive and final solution between Israel and the Arab world has been willing to find a lasting solution for that problem that we call the Arab-Israeli problem. It has been the Israelis and the Americans, because we must not separate the Israelis from the Americans in this case, who have refused any final solution to the Palestine-Israel question. And I cannot understand why, even from an Israeli perspective. Because Israel is a small state. I know that Israel has been a military state, the military elites, although Israel claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East. Of course, to me, that claim is extremely false. And, I can give you lots of examples, but take one major example that you may not be aware of. I've never seen a democratic state or even a dictatorial state that would confiscate or expropriate the lands of its own citizens or parts of its own citizenship, like the Palestinians in Israel. Like the Palestinians in Israel in 1948 owned 70% of the land. Nowadays they own only 5% of the land. And it is, all the time, it is only Palestinian land that is being expropriated by the Israeli government, let's say for military purposes or this and that purpose. But no one would accept that in Canada. No one would accept that in any country in the world if your land gets confiscated because of your ethnic community. If you are a native Indian or if you are, let's say, a Chinese or you are whatever, no one would accept that. But this has happened and still happening in the only democracy in the Middle East, in Israel. And it's amazing that many of my friends, Jewish friends, outside of Israel, do not know that. They do not know some of these essential facts. And this is not from my perspective. It's from the perspective of the state. You know, you go to the state's record or records about land, and they will tell you. And once the land is salvaged or redeemed, it can never be sold to a non-Jew, even if that non-Jew were to be a citizen of the state of Israel. That's to say, in Israel we have this curious phenomenon in terms of identity, that you as a non-Jew might become a citizen of the state. You might be allowed to become a citizen of the state, but you will never be allowed to become a member of the Jewish community or Judaism. That's to say, Jewish feeling and Jewish identity takes precedence over citizenship in Israel. It's true that there are 1.5 million Palestinians who are citizens of the Israeli state, and many of them are refugees, you know, inside Israel, like in my hometown, Nazareth. As you well know, Nazareth, until 1948, had been primarily a Christian town. That's to say, 70% of its population had been Arab Christian, 30% Muslim. Arab Muslim. After 48, because lots of refugees came from the different towns and villages surrounding Nazareth, Nazareth became primarily a Muslim city. And these refugees who became Israeli citizens were not allowed to go back to their lands within Israel that are only 5 miles away or 10 miles away from Nazareth. And this is well documented. If you take the major reverend who is now the Archbishop of the Catholic Church in the Near East, by the name of Father Elias Shakur, who was my high school teacher in Nazareth. In his two major books in English, We Belong to the Land and Blood Brothers, he tells you that he was born in a city or village on nowadays the Israeli-Lebanese border called Ikrith. And the city was forcibly evacuated in 1948 by the Israeli army. The army promised them that after the termination of hostilities with the Lebanese, they would go back, and they have never been allowed to go back ever since. So that we have a major dilemma here in terms of, you know, the concept of what we call democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East. Now the question is, you know, especially for us and somebody like me who comes from that part of the world initially, You know, I learned how to forget about anger and hostility a long time ago. Because, you know, it's self-defeating to be angry all the time. It doesn't help. But there's no doubt that there are lots of Arabs and Muslims and Palestinians who are extremely angry. There's no doubt about it. And now they are angry, you know, even the smallest child in Palestine knows that the problem is not Israel per se, it is the USA. You know, they don't have to read a book or even watch TV or Al Jazeera or whatever. They know that. So the question is, how to stop this anger? How to stop these hostilities? And I would say that, you know, in a highly objective way, that the recent attack on Gaza did not stem the anger. On the contrary, it increased the anger. It flared it up, not only amongst the Palestinians, but amongst all the Muslims. I mean, in a city like Rabat, Morocco, 2 million people demonstrated in the streets. In Jakarta, Indonesia, all over the Arab and non-Muslim world, people have become angry. It's like the Palestine situation has come back to haunt all of them. Now, this is, you know, I feel bad about all of this for a number of reasons. One is mainly because of the long tradition of coexistence between Jews and Muslims that lasted for centuries. But I also feel bad because of Jewish suffering at the hands of the Nazis in World War II. And the way that this suffering had been exploited by the Israeli state to punish another nation. And I feel bad that these atrocities committed at the hands of the Israeli state are a betrayal to Jewish tradition, Jewish ethics, and Jewish morality. In a sense, Judaism must not be limited to Israel. It's like we cannot limit Islam to Saudi Arabia or to the Emirate of Kandahar of Taliban that is protected by the Canadian Army nowadays. The Canadian Army is on the lookout for moderate Muslims in Kandahar. Yeah, because Islam cannot be limited to a territory. It's like Judaism cannot be limited to a territory. It's much more than that. So I feel that with these atrocities committed by a nation state, by a highly aggressive military elite, by a highly insane military elite, this is a major betrayal of Judaism, Jewish ethic, and Jewish morality, and the whole centuries of coexistence between Jews and Muslims. And the question that faces us, of course, what face us are lots of questions, not only one question. But one major question that faces us is how to go beyond anger. And there is so much of it. How to go beyond anger to rectify this situation. You know, there are lots of Arabs and Muslims and perhaps Americans and Canadians who are pinning their hopes on the new president of the USA to rectify all of this. But then Bush, you know, 3 months before he left office, created a major economic mess. Now, I would not say that, you know, it was not his fault, because people say Clinton began that process. Anyway, it's a complicated thing, of course, but it broke out 3-4 months ago. It's a major internal thing as well as external thing in the history of capitalism. How can we find a solution? So that's not, you know, precisely only one problem. It's a lot of problems that the USA is facing nowadays. But I think that it is very crucial. It is very crucial for the USA, as the most powerful country in the world, to find a lasting and just solution to the Palestine-Israel conflict. And I believe that the USA has the power to do that. Because now in the minds of most Arabs and Muslims, the USA is to be blamed for the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people. Now, you know, if I were in Israel, I would say the same thing, but perhaps in a much more diplomatic way to my friends in the Israeli Jewish community. Because I think that one of the major problems of Zionism is that Zionism, in its past century or so, has built so many walls of denial, denying that, you know, we stole land. You know, like ethnic cleansing, this did not happen. The Palestinians left because, you know, it's like they came from Syria, so they went back to Syria. They came from Transjordan, you know, or they came from Egypt, they went back. You know, we came back to our land and they went back to their land. So there has been a wall of denials built by the Zionist movement, by the Zionist project, for the past century or so, about the Palestinians, about the Arabs and the Muslims. And I think that what is extremely important for us is to have an honest dialogue. I don't know how we can have it, you know, maybe in the desert emirate of Qatar, you know, now they love dialogue with the Christian world because they want the Christians to come and spend their money in Qatar, since the Indians are spending their money in Dubai, and you know, all of this. This is not the type of dialogue I'm talking about. You know, if Hamas is the enemy, you have to sit down and dialogue with Hamas. It's like the PLO until 15 years ago, Fatah especially, had been the enemy of the state of Israel. And it was illegal in Israel, or in the West Bank, or in Gaza, even to utter the word Fatah. And you know that the Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon and Beirut of 1982 had the intended consequence of annihilating any influence for the PLO on the West Bank and Gaza. So it was a taboo to talk to the PLO. But then the Israelis sat down and talked to the PLO. They sat down and talked to Arafat, to late Arafat. I mean, Arafat was the quintessential terrorist. But then suddenly he was portrayed on Israeli TV and by Israeli media and American media as a laughing Arafat. It's like the laughing Buddha in the culture of Southeast Asia, you know. Now, Arafat is a moderate man. You know, we can't deal with him. But if Israel and the USA sat down with Arafat, why wouldn't they sit down with Hamas? Because Hamas did not come out of the blue. I think that Hamas as a movement is a symbol of the frustration of the Palestinian people. A frustration that has been built up since 1948, to say the least. And one way of ending this madness is for the Israeli leadership and for the Palestinian leadership to sit down and talk. And if they cannot sit down and talk, then they have to be forced to sit down and talk by another power. And this other power, and the only power, is perhaps the USA. Now, one final point is, I think that the USA has lost so much credibility in the Muslim world since at least 9/11, since the tragic attacks on the USA of 9/11. So much of it. Because of the crazy policies of Bush, because of the occupation of Iraq, because of his unwillingness to find a solution to the Palestine question, because of his support for dictatorship in the Arab world and the Muslim world. You know, most of these dictators are there because of U.S. support. I mean, Mubarak has been at the helm since October 1981. Imagine that. And now he's preparing for his son, Jamal, to rule Egypt after he departs. And when he leaves, not that he wants to leave, it's because God wants him to leave. And this is true with Gaddafi of Libya, with, you know, different kings and royals in there. But I would say that their destiny and their fate is very much tied up to the desires of the American administration. And the Americans have allowed these dictators to survive. The Americans are not serious about spreading democracy in the Arab and the Muslim worlds. And as you well know, Hamas came to power through democratic means. But since day one, it has been fought by the Americans and the Israelis. You know, Hamas did not come to power because it staged a coup against, you know, a certain authority. it came to power because it was voted in by the Palestinians on the West Bank as well as in Gaza. So I think that for the fact that the USA has lost so much credibility in the past 7-8 years, you know, this is a major battle to fight by the current Obama administration. And the question is, will that administration succeed in reversing the tide and in creating a better atmosphere of reconciliation between the Muslim world and between the USA? Not only between the Palestinians and the Israelis, but between the Muslim world and the USA. As you can see, the situation is much more complex and much more comprehensive than just the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think it is universal in nature, and that's why perhaps all of us are here tonight. Because this situation is not unique to only Arabs and Jews. It has become international in character. And we have to be honest. I mean, Arabs and Jews have to be honest with each other if they are to find a solution. So I'm going to stop here. I know that you have many questions to raise or comments to make, and you are welcome to do so.
Thanks. To speak precisely, it's a hell of a landscape. So, who would like to speak to this a little bit?
I have a question about the violation of human rights that happened over Gaza. We cannot deny that. And even in 21st century, if we can't have an organization that we can have them accountable for these kind of things, what kind of world are we living in? And second of all, what is the alternative to hold Israeli authorities, to hold them accountable for these innocent lives?
Yes. You know, the what's his name? The Ban Moon, is that the
Ban
name
Moon,
of the?
Yeah.
He was in Gaza like 2 days ago, and he was appalled by what he saw.
Yep.
Not only in terms of the Israeli attack on the United Nations, the UNRWA schools, but also the attack on Gaza by and large. The destruction of whole neighborhoods in Gaza and so on and so forth. You know, I mean, there is no doubt that the United Nations as a body is a major body in the world today. But the question is, has the United Nations, since its own establishment, been successful in stopping this type of genocide or killing in different parts of the world, not only in Palestine, not only in Gaza? There's no doubt that the United Nations as an institution has been somewhat weak because of the powers that run that institution. Yes, I mean, but however, you know, we must not forget that the United Nations has given so much aid to the Palestinians in terms of their UNRWA, especially since 1948, not only in what we call the West Bank, Gaza, but also to the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan since that time. Yeah. Yes, please.
You talked about politics in various aspects, but has there developed a culture of conflict that goes beyond politics, that you can come in and say, I want both of you to shake hands and be nice to yourselves and live amiably, and yet culturally there's generations now who are saying, I don't like you. You know, you did this to my ancestors and on and on and on, and we're not going to resolve it in, you know, so quickly by just signing an agreement or whatever else. Is there a culture of conflict?
That's a good question. I think that another question is whether there is a culture of forgiveness, especially amongst the Palestinians. And I know that from my family and other families that the Palestinians since 48 have been extremely forgiving of the Israeli Jewish people, that they just want to live in peace with them. That in principle, the Palestinians have no problem living with Jews, but they have a problem being dominated by one community, by, let's say, the State of Israel. So in terms of forgiveness, I think that the Palestinians will forgive if Israel were to say, well, we're going to pull out of the West Bank and Gaza, dismantle the walls and the settlements and all of that. Yes, that would lead to a culture of reconciliation and forgiveness between the Palestinians and Israeli Jews. But I think that, by and large, it depends on the wills and the desires of the Israeli state, the Israeli people, and the Israeli elites. You know, we must not forget that over 90% of the Israelis in the recent war supported the Israeli army in its onslaught against Gaza. So there is a culture of violence in Israeli society. It's a major culture of violence that the CNN does not talk about, because Israel is a Western implant in the Middle East. I think that for Israel to survive, if it wants to survive in what we call the Middle East, Israel has to become a Middle Eastern nation and not a European settler nation in the midst of Arabs and Muslims. And the way to do it, there are lots of ways to do that. You know, there is a historical precedent where Jews have lived, as I said, with Arabs and Muslims for a long time. This is not new. It's not new. And that's why ultimately I believe that the best solution, ultimately and ideally, would be the one-state solution. We already have Jews and Arabs living in what we call Israel-Palestine under one authority, which is the Israeli authority. So why not change the political structure of the Israeli state to allow this coexistence to be fostered by Arabs and Jews in what we call, you know, it could be called the Libyan leader Gaddafi a few years back said in an Arab summit that we should call this state Israel Palestine, that's to say Palestine Israel state, something like that. The terminology is not important, but what's important is that we have Arabs and Jews under one political hegemony, the Israeli hegemony nowadays, and perhaps ultimately the best thing would be to create one state. But of course Zionism would never accept that, except certain brands of Zionism. like, let's say in the 19th century, there was a major Zionist humanist philosopher by the name of Ahad Ha'am, one of the people, that's the name in Hebrew, Ahad Ha'am, who was a Russian Jewish philosopher. And he believed in one state, in a one-state solution. So I think that hopefully we pray that this would be the way to go in the future.
Can I just push that a little bit with you, Ibrahim? Thomas Friedman in 2002, you know, the New York Times columnist,
yes,
visited all of the states surrounding Israel. And I listened to him discussing the fruit of those conversations. And one of the things that he said, which I was so taken aback by, was that he could see for the first time the possibility of Israel becoming a Middle East Arab state. And he saw this as awful because it would mean that it would be unsupportable by America.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now I listen to you say this, and the penny drops for me a little bit. So what we're looking at there is the, as you argued this evening
yes,
in such a forceful way, this intimate connection
mm-hmm.
between Israel and America.
Yes.
And also with the historical founding of Israel within the context of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But Friedman also went on to say that that period, and I'd be interested in your sense of it, that period of a kind of a kind of European orientation to the state of Israel. I mean, he was arguing that that's about to be over.
Yeah, I haven't seen that article. I'd like to see that. But as you well know, within Israeli society, if you look at the Israeli society itself, and the major sociologist who has written on Israeli society is the American Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling, The Invention and the Decline of Israelness, published by University of California Press in 1992. It's an amazing book on the nature of the Israeli state. But basically, he sees three major divisions within Israeli society. The first major one is what we call Ashkenazi Jews, Jews who had migrated from Europe. And the second one is Sephardic Jews, Spaniard or Arab Jews, so to speak. Iraqi, Yemeni, Moroccan, Egyptian, Tunisian, etc. And the third one is Russian Jews.
Mm-hmm. recent.
Who began to migrate en masse since 96 or so. So these are the three major divisions within Israeli society. Of course, you can talk about the Falasha Jews who came from Ethiopia, but the Falasha are not more than 100,000 or so in Israel. So in that division, there's no doubt that Arab Jews, number-wise, have been the majority until the Russian Jews came. But the Arab Jews feel within the Israeli state that their own ethos and culture, the Arab Jewish culture, had been destroyed by the Ashkenazi community. Mm-hmm. And now with the coming of the Russian Jews, they have no place within Israeli society.
So
the question is how to empower perhaps the Sephardic Jewish community within Israel. Because that Sephardic Jewish community, to my mind, that one of the major problems in Zionism too is that Zionism has invited Jews to migrate, to leave their own original countries and to come to Israel. And that happened with the largest Jewish community in the Arab world, the Moroccan Jewish community. Before the State of Israel in Morocco, there had been 400,000 Jews before 1948, most of whom have migrated to Israel after 1948, some of whom have gone to France or whatever, Europe, but the majority went to Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Lod, whatever. And these people, in a sense, you know, I mean, of course, they have been assimilated into Israeli society, but many of them feel that they are not on an equal footing with the Ashkenazi Jewish community within Israeli society. So how can we empower Sephardic Jews to perhaps create a rapprochement between Israel as a state and the larger Arab world?
Based on a common ethos.
That's right. And history and civilization. Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yes, sir.
I just heard a comment recently on a study I'm doing that indicated that, along the lines of the figures you gave us earlier, that around the time of about 100 AD, the Jewish diaspora, two-thirds of the Jews lived outside
Palestine.
So it sounds like not much has changed in the racial. The other thing I found interesting, too, is I read a little while ago Karen Armstrong's book, The Battle for God.
Yes.
And we have this situation, which it sounds like you just have confirmed, that you have these extremists, American right-wing fundamentalist Christians, of whom Bush supported Bush, supporting this idea of the Zionist idea. And the Zionist idea, as I understood from Karen Armstrong, was that only Jews would be allowed in Israel. No other.
Of course, that's a big story. You're talking about Christian Zionism. Mm-hmm. And the Christian Zionist movement have an embassy in Jerusalem. They've had it for a long time. I don't know whether you know the late Palestinian-American professor, you know of the late Palestinian, Edward Said, S-A-I-D, who wrote the major book, Orientalism. The Zionist, Christian Zionist embassy occupies his house, the house of his father and grandfather, and he's a Christian Arab. And I think that that's a very long story, but the tragedy of Christian Zionism, to my mind, you know, to me, I grew up in a Christian environment. I'm not Christian. Thanks God. Alhamdulillah. But I grew up in a Christian environment. I grew up in a Christian town. I studied in Catholic schools.
On the Day of Judgment.
Lord. I know that. I'm saying that because many of you Protestants would not admit Catholics into Christianity. You know, I'm saying that from a theological Christian perspective. I think that the tragedy of Christian Zionism is that Christianity, to my understanding, is about compassion and ethics. This is the ethics of Jesus. It's the loving, not only of the neighbor, but of the enemy. And Christian Zionism does not seem to love its own people, the Christian, Palestinian Christians.
They don't exist for them.
But they do exist.
They don't exist for them. They don't exist with Israel.
Let alone loving the Muslims. Yeah, that's a big issue, of course. Yes, sir.
So the envoy from the U.S. now, appointed Mitchell.
Yes.
He's going to be pursuing a two-state solution.
Inshallah, God willing. But so that has been the American position for a long time.
For a long time.
Yes.
Do you see that then just falling aground then, just not making it? And how would Obama, why would Obama move in that direction?
You know, that's not a new move, as you well know. No. Clinton moved in that direction, Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. and all of that. But the question is, will Obama succeed in creating a Palestinian state? We already have an Israeli state on the West Bank and Gaza, a sovereign, independent Palestinian state. That's the question. Now, the Palestinians, or some of them, have hopes that, yes, Obama might be able to do that. I do not know about this, you know. I don't want to have hopes then see my hopes dashed in 4 years or so. But let's say, inshallah, like we say in the Middle East, God willing, that this will happen. Yeah. It's like, you know, my father and mother gave birth to 13 of us. And when I was a bit older, I said, "Dad, how come that you gave birth to 13 of us?" He said, "Inshallah, you will survive." Yeah. God willing, you will survive. So let's say, inshallah, we will survive. Yes. Yes, please.
Of course, a big problem with the tier state is Jerusalem.
Yes. Of course, you know, that's a huge problem. But the question is, you know, Jerusalem is a piece of property. If we cannot find a solution to the problem, to the human problem, especially human tragedy of the Palestinians, I mean, I don't care about Jerusalem ultimately. What I care about is about people who are created by God.
Of course, but the point is, for the Jews, Jerusalem is important.
For the Muslims and the Christians, yeah, and all of that. For everybody.
From a religious point of view.
Yes. And if you look at the, once again, at the long Islamic centuries, Jews had never been barred from living in Jerusalem. You know, historically. No Jew was ever barred from living in Jerusalem. There had always been Jews living in
after
Jerusalem, in Hebron, sorry?
After 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a special situation because of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Yes, that's true. By Jordan, yes. But in terms of the long Islamic, you know, during the Ottomans were in Palestine for 400 years, 402 years. And Jews had been in Jerusalem, Hebron, Tiberias, Acre, Jaffa for a long time. Yes. Any other question? Yes.
Over the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a growing division between Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
Yes.
Do you think they've moved apart so far now that they could never be one state?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. As you well know, after 1948, Gaza, the Gaza Strip, was placed in the hands of the Egyptian authorities, of King Farouk and later on Nasser, after he came in 1952. And Palestinians on the West Bank were placed in the hands of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan that became officially the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan in 49, 1 year after 48, after the creation of Israel. Now, to me, you know, I mean, I come from that part of the land. To me, you know, the Palestinians in Gaza, I'm not talking about the refugees, but the Palestinians of Gaza and Arish, the original inhabitants, are closer to being Egyptian than Palestinian. You know, because the creation of national boundaries, you know, was done 100 years ago or so. But in history, most of these people in Gaza thought of themselves to be like part of Egypt. Either Ottoman Egypt or even British Egypt after the British conquered Egypt in 1882 and so on and so forth. So in that sense, there has always been a dichotomy between Gaza and the West Bank. Because the West Bank and Jordan always felt they are part of what we call Bilad al-Sham. Bilad al-Sham in history means the four countries that we talk about today, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan. This is Bilad al-Sham. It was one unit under the Ottomans. Whereas Gaza did not feel it was part of Bilad al-Sham historically, but it was part of Egypt. Now, when the Egyptian administration took over, especially after Nasser came to power in 52, what the Nasserism did it nationalized education. So lots of Palestinians began to go to Egyptian universities and study all sorts of sciences. And that's why the education rate in Gaza is the highest amongst the Palestinians, although most of them are refugees. Because of the policy of the Egyptian administration after 1952. And we know that, let's say, jihad, Palestinian jihad, was born in Egypt originally. And Hamas was born in Egypt. It was called the Muslim Brotherhood Movement. So there are huge ties between Hamas jihad on the one hand and the Islamic movements of Egypt on the other hand, because of the proximity of Egypt and the whole historical connection between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. But of course, there had always been people in Gaza who wanted to be independent of Egypt, especially the people who were supported by the British, like such as the mayor of Gaza, who comes from the family of Ashawa. We have a friend here whose father was the mayor. He is now in Cairo. But he has an amazing story to tell about the history of the family of Shawa and how it was persecuted by the Egyptians, how it supported the British during the Mandate and later on the Israelis, and so on and so forth. It's very interesting to see the position of the elites of Gaza over the past century vis-a-vis the Egyptians or the other Palestinians. That in a sense they wanted to be independent of both. Now nowadays, you know, Gaza and the West Bank are not connected by any route. They are separated by Israel. It's like they remind me of Pakistan before Bangladesh became a state. West Pakistan and East Pakistan, they were 5,000 miles apart. This is not as bad, of course. It's like 100 miles apart or so, but still. Israel is in the middle. So how can we create one Palestinian state for the West Bank and Gaza? That's a problem, but it's not a huge problem, I believe.
Do you want to pursue it further?
Yeah, I'm just wondering now if conditions in the West Bank are much better than in Gaza, and if there would be the will of the people in the West Bank to even continue having Gaza as part of this
yes.
one state idea, and if also if Israel, it wouldn't be their advantage to really beat Gaza down and in effect have the West Bank look at that and say that's not what we want for us in the future.
Yeah. You know, as you well know, I don't know whether you have been to the West Bank or not. The last time I was on the West Bank in Ramallah and Nablus was 2 years ago. And when you see the wall cutting off Palestinian communities, you know, it's like, it's horrible that wall built with American money and Israeli companies on the West Bank, on West Bank land. So the Palestinian Authority, and I want to be somewhat objective about that because I have many friends in the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority have become less than mayors on the West Bank. It's like the mayor, do you have a mayor here in Camrose?
Oh, yeah, and he's here tonight.
The mayor of Camrose might have a larger budget than the mayors on the West Bank. And above all, he or she does not need a permit to go to Edmonton or Calgary. Whereas if you are a mayor of Ramallah or whatever, you need a permit to go to Nablus or Jenin, whatever, from the Israeli authorities. So their position has been very much reduced by the Israeli army. And also we must remember that the Israeli army pulled out of the major cities such as Nablus or Jenin, but it did not leave the West Bank. You know, if you, my hometown is only 20 minutes away from the West Bank. You know, if you go to the Palestinian city of Jenin in the northern West Bank, which is very close to Afula and Nazareth, only 20 minutes away from Nazareth, you know, and you drive to Nablus from Jenin, it's a 1 hour drive. By the time you get out of Jenin from the south, you see Israeli military camps. So they did not leave the West Bank. And it seems that they had never intended to leave the West Bank. And it's very clear that, you know, to the world, at least now, that Israel has not been serious about Oslo. Because if they had been serious, they would have left the West Bank entirely to the Palestinians. The West Bank and Gaza are 24% of classical Palestine. And the Palestinians, even, as I said, Hamas, had been willing to accept 24% as a future Palestinian state. In addition, what the Palestinian authorities have done during the recent Israeli attack on Gaza is that they have closed down 50 charitable organizations out of 56 that had been claimed by Hamas on the West Bank. And they have put 700 Hamas activists in prisons during the last Israeli assault on Gaza. So in a sense, where Israel had failed to pacify the Palestinians, the Palestinian Authority that came from Tunis and Yemen and Libya, whatever, has succeeded so far in pacifying the Palestinians. But that doesn't mean that it has stemmed or finished or terminated their anger at occupation, because they see occupation in the wall, in Israeli settlements, in Israeli settlers who mostly come from New York City, armed and shooting Palestinians left and right or attacking Palestinian villages at night. It happens almost every night. I studied on the West Bank. I went to Beer Zeit University. And it's amazing. I used to speak to Israeli soldiers who would attack our campus in Hebrew, and they would be shocked. What are you doing here? You are one of us. And it's like, you know, they would train their young soldiers on us as college students at Beer Zeit. Now, I think that, you know, the larger question is, if Israel wants to live a sane and peaceful life, Israel has to change itself from a military society to a peaceful society, to a civil society. But so far, it's a major military society, the most powerful military society in the Middle East. Yes?
We still have the rhetoric, though, of, or that's what we're told anyway in the news, of Hamas having as a principal idea of kicking all the Jews out of
That's what the PLO also had. But they sat down and talked to the PLOs. So what prevents them from talking to Hamas? Yes?
As you have described, it's been very helpful for me in my understanding. You've described Israel as having the U.S. as an external power and ideological source.
Yes.
Does Hamas have an external power
yes.
and ideological source?
Thank you. That's a very good question. You know, this type of question has been asked so much about Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And the claim has been made, and it is an accurate claim that Iran had been behind Hezbollah. But it's partially accurate, or that's like the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. You know, there are lots of questions. I need to come back here, David.
Please do.
Yeah. You know, briefly, historically, you know, Iran became Shiite, and you might ask me about the differences between Shiism and Sunnism in Islam. That's another story.
Everybody here
but
knows that.
Iran. Iran became Shiite in the 16th century only, because before 1501, Iran had been a staunch Sunnite country, just like Saudi Arabia today. It was not Wahhabi, but it was strong in Sunni Islam. Iran became Shiite in 1501 under the Safavid state. Okay, and because it became Shiite, Iran found out, the Iranian regime, the Safavids, found out that they did not have Shia clergy, professors, teachers of theology. So they began to import them from South Lebanon. And that's why the relationship between South Lebanon, the Shiite community in South Lebanon, and Iran and Shiism is at least 500 years old. It did not begin with Hezbollah. Okay. So there have been many long historical and theological connections between South Lebanon, especially what we call Jabal Amil, that's the area where most of the Shiite Lebanese are, and between Iran. And that's why it was normal for the Iranians, even under the Shah, to support the Shiites of Lebanon. It's not new. So when the Islamic Revolution came to power after 79, it began to support Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Shiites in Lebanon because of that historical precedent, and also because of its own new strategy in the Middle East vis-a-vis the different Arab states and Israel and the USA. So now, let's say, of course, the situation is much more complicated nowadays than 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. It has become more complicated due to the American occupation of Iraq. Because, you know, the Bush administration and the neocons in their own ignorance never predicted that the major winner of their occupation of Iraq would be Iran and Shiism. And that's what has happened. Because Iran, in a sense, came to control Iraq for free at the expense of American army, American troops, and American money. The Iranians did not even fire one shot. They did not need to. And most of the leaders of the current regime in Iraq are either Iranian citizens or have been trained in Iran. Because, you know, Iran has stood against the Ba'ath Party and against Saddam Hussein for at least 20 years. And that's why Iran has a major ally in Iraq. And most probably, if the Americans withdraw completely from Iraq, Iran would have a major influence, the major influence, over Iraqi state and Iraqi politics. That's a major success and expansion for Iranian strategic interests nowadays. And it seems to me that this is the reason why the Bush administration was so scared of attacking Iran. It has threatened to attack Iran. Another major reason is that they did not have money to do it. But thank God, alhamdulillah. But also one major reason is that the Iranians played politics in a very cool way, because Iraq was given to them for free by the Americans. And because the Americans were claiming that they were pacifying Iraq, they did not want Iraq to flare up in case they attacked Iran. And Iraq would have flared up. I mean, the American army would have been attacked left and right, not only by Sunnites and the Sunni triangle, but by Shiites and Kurds and everyone in Iraq. And the Americans could not afford to do that. Now, when it comes to Lebanon, as I said, you know, the relationship between Lebanese Shiism and Iran is a very long relationship. It's not new at all. But with the strategic alliances, with the fact that Iran is emerging as a major power in the area, perhaps the second major power after Israel in the area, Iran is playing its own cards in a very careful way. And it has used Hezbollah in a major way. Now, the question is, has Iran used Hamas? That's the question. Now, I do not know the real answer to that. I mean, the Israelis say yes. I mean, Iran has armed and trained Hamas and all of that. But I doubt it. I think that most of the arms and the training have come from the Muslim Brotherhood movement in both Egypt and the Sudan, I think. I have no proof, but we must remember that Hamas is the Palestinian offshoot or branch of Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood movement. Of course, Iran might have trained a number of Hamas fighters, but I think that most of the training and the arms have come from the Muslim Brotherhood movement in Egypt and the Sudan and North Africa. So what does that mean? It means that, you know, in the recent Israeli attack, as you know, there has been a major polarization in the Arab world between the Arab street, the Arab masses, and the Arab regimes. A significant number of Arab regimes, such as the Saudi regime and the Egyptian regime and the Jordanian and the Moroccan or whatever, stood on the side of Israel in the war against Hamas. Why? Because these regimes have been anti-Islamic movement from the beginning. So it is normal for them to stand against Hamas. In addition, they did not want Hamas to succeed in the war, because that will give a clear lesson and symbol to their Islamic movements that they can fight their own regimes and succeed and win against the regimes. And that's why the Arab world has been extremely polarized at that level. In addition, of course, the Arab regimes have played the card of Iran. Oh, Iran is trying to spread Shiism amongst the Sunnis and all of that. But most Sunnis, some of them have bought it, but most of them have not bought that one. Except perhaps in Lebanon. The Sunnis of Lebanon, by and large, have bought the charge that Shiism is trying to dominate not only Lebanon, but Syria as well. But we must remember that the upper echelon, the Syrian regime is Shiite anyway, it is Alawite, which is a branch of Shiism. In terms of Hamas, I think that in terms of theology, there's a significant difference between the Hamas Muslim Brothers theology and the theology of Shiism. There's a major difference. But certain people in Gaza have accepted Shiism. And I would say that less than 1% of the Palestinian population, unlike Shiism in Lebanon, which has been entrenched for centuries, it's historical in nature and so on and so forth. So here we have that polarization between the Arab regimes on the one hand that have supported Israel, and between the Arab masses. And in a sense, the Arab regime since the war in Lebanon 2.5 years ago have played the card of Shiism, saying, well, the Shiites are going to convert all the Sunnis to Shiism and this. But the Arab street has not bought that as of yet. And that's why there has been so much anger, not only against Israel in the recent onslaught, but against the Arab regimes as well. And perhaps this is one reason why Israel was begged by the Arab regimes to stop the war. Because the war went on. I mean, those regimes, I would suspect, those regimes must, as well as with the Israeli regime, must have thought that it would take them maximum a week or so to eliminate the power of Hamas in Gaza, because Hamas is not near in power, not near Hezbollah of Lebanon. Hezbollah is much more powerful. They never expected that the war would drag on for 23 days. And it did drag on for 23 days. And in a sense, Israel did not achieve. Of course, Israel has wrought so much destruction and damage in Gaza, but it did not achieve its strategic purpose of destroying Hamas. Hamas is not destroyed. On the contrary, I believe that Hamas has emerged much more powerful amongst the Palestinian masses and the Arab and the Muslim masses than before. And the fear is that this type of alliance, this type of rallying behind Hamas, might create a Qaeda-type community in the Arab and Muslim world that might decide in the future to attack Israel in the way that the U.S. was attacked in 9/11. I would say God forbid, but the question is, you know, you can see that there's so much anger that Israel has created amongst Arabs and Muslims that the Israeli leaders did not think about the long-term consequences for that. It's in the same way that the American leaders for a long time since World War II never thought about the long-term consequences of their actions overseas, not only in the Muslim world, but in Latin America and China, in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam, in Korea, this and that.
In Iran in 52.
In Iran in 52, yes. That's right.
Well, I wish that I could say it was unnecessary for us to spend more time learning about this complex and demanding landscape. But I fear it is absolutely necessary for us to learn a great deal more about it. And I'm grateful to you for coming and beginning to unfold some of the layers of this for us.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.